Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a couple of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Lawrence O'Donnell, who is the Emmy-winning producer of NBC's The West Wing. He's also MSNBC's senior political analyst and a panelist on the McLaughlin Group. And he's a former contributing editor to the New York Magazine and a former Democratic chief of staff of the United States Senate Committee on Finance and the United States Senate Committee on the Environment and Public Works. Mr. O'Donnell also served as a senior advisor to Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan. Talking about the likely ascension of Howard Dean to run the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, and whether or not the progressives can take over the Democratic Party, or the lesson of the last election is to recapture the center. So I'll be looking into those scenarios. We'll also go to Tehran in Iran and talk with Borzu Dargani, who is the Mideast correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. He just got in from Iraq. He wrote a piece describing the recent elections in Iraq as the Sistani tsunami. So we'll be talking about the unintended consequences of an election which perhaps the White House is guilty of premature elation. But the White House and the press seem to think it was a resounding success. However, the results indicate that the Dawa and the Supreme Council will be the dominant force in Iraq. And both of them have strong ties to Iran. So we'll be talking with Borzu Dargani about that. And continue on that subject with Dr. Juan Cole, who's widely considered to be one of our leading scholars on contemporary Iraq. Dr. Cole is a professor of modern Middle East history and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. And then we'll also talk about the President's State of the Union and vis-a-vis his talk about making a consumer-driven healthcare regime in this country. We'll talk with Dr. John Gaiman, who's the president of Physicians for a National Health Program and author of the just released book, Falling Through the Safety Net, Americans Without Health Insurance. We're talking about the president's prescription for an out-of-control health system, which is responsible, as a Harvard study recently indicated, for most of the bankruptcies in this country. Personal bankruptcies are to do with medical bills, and it's also the leading cause of bankruptcies among small businesses, the inability to maintain the health plans. Lawrence O'Donnell, given that it looks as if Howard Dean is pretty much a shoo-in to be the new head of the DNC, why these calls or op-eds suggesting that the Democrats are in a suicide pact, given that, as far as I recall, most heads of DNC heads are sort of backroom money raisers, and at least Dean's got a high profile. He's proven himself at the grassroots. Isn't he more likely to be more successful, more visible, and more effective?
Yes, this is a better job for him than running for president. The problem with the columnists and the pundits who are calling this a terrible idea is that they are stuck back in their 2004 presidential campaign analysis, not in the analysis of what's involved in running the Democratic Party. It's a good move for Dean. It's a good move for the party. It's a good move for the Democrats, including, in my view, the prohibition that it carries for Howard Dean running for president. I think Howard Dean, as a presidential candidate, now is condemned to be labeled by his past. And, of course, that includes some mislabeling by the media, for example, about the Dean scream that night when he was giving his concession speech in Iowa. If you were in the room where he gave that, it did not sound like a scream at all. But the way it went into the network microphones and went through their control rooms without them tampering with it in any way, he was just way too close to those microphones to do it that way. So, but I think he would be a bad presidential candidate for the Democrats because of the way he's been labeled, and he's stuck with that label. He's a very smart guy. I knew him when he was governor of Vermont, and he used to come down and testify to the Senate where I was working on the Senate Finance Committee. And he's full of expertise on policy, and is actually, I never thought of Howard Dean as a liberal, never, when he was governor of Vermont. I thought of him as an agile moderate who took a couple of liberal positions here and there, and looked to me like he was jumping from iceberg to iceberg on those. It didn't look consistent, and so I'm simply saying he's not the liberal he's been painted to be. He's a very effective spokesman. He'll be very good on Meet the Press. He'll be very good in the public forums. And if you make the mistake of looking at the head of the party in terms of what is his presidential electability, well, then you never would have had Ron Brown be the head of the party. You never would have had Terry McAuliffe be the head of the party. These party heads are generally, frequently, not even very presentable in public.
Well, apropos Dean not being a liberal, he did in his run up, as he established himself as a spokesman, he assiduously moved to the center. He, in fact, when he made that comment about the party needs to address the guys with Confederate flags on the pickup trucks, he got sort of roundly booed. But that, I thought his mistake there was that he apologized.
Yeah, and, you know, he was, look, Vermont has a lot of guys with American flags on pickup trucks, too. It's not the Vermonters that, you know, some people know who've moved up from New York or from Boston after making a lot of money. And, you know, Vermont was very capable of electing Republicans during Howard Dean's time, and so he knew how to talk to those people, and I think still does. If you could get him, if he could somehow step out of his label that we in the media will insist on handcuffing him to for the rest of his life.
Well, there's conflicting data out there about if you poll the, say, the red states, as others have done, it indicates that if you avoid talking about God, guns, and gays, and you talk about bread and butter issues, it turns out that many people in the center and in the south, in the so-called red states, are by most definitions fairly progressive. Alternatively, we're talking about whether you try and recapture the center or go the progressive direction, the history of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party gives you pause, because in 1968, first of all, since Harry Truman, only centrist Democrats have been elected president. And in 1968, the liberal wing deserted Humphrey for McCarthy and helped elect Nixon. In 1980, in the primaries, they deserted Carter for Teddy Kennedy. In the general, they deserted Carter for a Republican, John Anderson, and helped elect Reagan. Enough progressives in 2000, 96,000, and voted in Florida for Ralph Nader, and Bush won by 536 votes. So there's a looking at the stark record, it doesn't seem like the progressives have actually helped keep Democrats in power.
Well, that's one way to look at it, but they've also been a kind of center of gravity for the Democratic Party over the decades, and which has been extremely successful in arriving at fairly liberal outcomes in governing, but only when there was a Republican president and a Democratic Congress. The Democratic Congress that Ronald Reagan had to live with controlled him, and so also with the first President Bush. And there was a lot of not so very visible, successful liberalism being legislated at that time in the innards of the bills we were passing in the House and the Senate. The last election, I actually think, was the high watermark for liberalism in the Democratic presidential campaign history, because John Kerry, there's really no way around it, really is a Massachusetts liberal. I'm from Boston. I remember his very first campaign for Congress. I know him. He didn't shy away from that label. It's the most painful label you can have in American politics. There are no two words worse than Massachusetts and liberal, and he came within 70,000 votes. If you flip 70,000 votes in Ohio, the Massachusetts liberal gets elected president of the United States. That's amazing to me. Here's somebody who's not a death penalty hawk like every other Democrat out there who runs for high office, and was running against a war very early in that war Unlike the 1972 situation where George McGovern was running against the Vietnam War, you know, after 10 years of American disaster there. And what Kerry achieved electorally to me is a very, very impressive win for the left side of the Democratic Party. And it doesn't indicate to me that the Democratic Party needs to move rightward. I think it's very wise to do what Hillary Clinton wants it to do, which is to be careful of the rhetoric and don't look like you are an enthusiast for abortion, but look like someone who's prepared to allow it in practical circumstances.
In other words, be tolerant.
Exactly, yeah. And so I actually think that if there's a swerve too far rightward for Democrats, that they're actually making a mistake, that the Kerry campaign was an extremely successful campaign. Look, when we watch, in the Super Bowl today, okay, if the Patriots win by 1 point, we're not going to say that the other team was destroyed. We're not going to say that, you know, Philadelphia should be banned from ever trying this again. We're going to say, wow, those were two extremely competitive teams, and it's amazing, you know, that the underdog came within 1 point of winning. In politics, when someone loses, we just condemn them and we say there was something wrong with them and it's their fault and all of this stuff. And instead of recognizing just how difficult the mountain the Kerry campaign had to climb against a president who began the election cycle, 2 years before the election with an approval rating in the 80 percentile. There was no real prospect when the presidential campaign began of the Democrats winning, and in the end, the Democrats didn't, and they shouldn't be shocked by that.
Well, I'm hoping that Philadelphia wins because I'd like to see McNabb repudiate the gratuitous racism of Rush Limbaugh, who suggested that the only reason that McNabb was a good quarterback was because he was black. He'd been helped along, in other words, by affirmative action.
Rather than his
manifest talents, you know.
Yeah, and Rush has been struggling with that ever since, with clarifications ever since. But I'm a big Donovan McNabb fan, and I love the breakthrough that has occurred for him as a African American quarterback, and how rare that is. But I'm from Boston, so I just I'm afraid I tilt a certain way
right.
on this one.
Well, let's go back to what you were saying earlier, though. Where you suggested that Howard Dean, because his experiences in Vermont was more, he's friendly to the NRA, he's more able to talk to people in the red states. That was clearly Bill Clinton's great talent, that you can be a liberal in the heartland as long as you speak in the local vernacular, and nobody was more in effect a poster boy for traditional Northeastern Harvard-type liberalism than John Kerry. So what's the prescription here, though?
I'm going to be a lone voice on this mathematics. Let's remember that John Kerry got more votes for president than Bill Clinton ever did. Bill Clinton did not run as a liberal. Bill Clinton ran as a conservative Democrat from the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, which was basically at that time a Southern Democrat group. Bill Clinton stopped his campaign to go execute a learning disabled guy in Arkansas to prove his conservative credentials to America. He still got 43% of the vote. That's what he got, and he got the presidency thanks to Ross Perot. If we had had a third-party candidate coming from Texas this time, running against the huge deficits run up by President Bush, which was the Ross Perot issue, deficits. If that candidate had come into the race, John Kerry would be president now. When Bill Clinton became president in the second year of his presidency, he tried to become suddenly the most liberal president we'd ever had by legislating his massive health care plan that Hillary helped conceive for him. And that was by far the most liberal notion since the civil rights movement advanced in American government, and it got absolutely nowhere. And then for the remaining 6 years of his presidency, he was ruled by the Republican Party in the Congress, and he was a minor editor of their work. Everything that happened domestically in the government was the work of Newt Gingrich at that point.
But who do you hold accountable for the fact that in 92, the Democrats controlled all the branches of the government, which is what we have now with the Republicans essentially being a one-party state? What, those 2 years, nothing got done. So
A lot of things got done in those first 2 years. We had 57 Democrats in the United States Senate. That's more than the Republicans have now. Right. In Bill Clinton's first 2 years, a lot of things got done. NAFTA was pushed through. The World Trade Agreement was pushed through. The biggest deficit reduction program in history was pushed through, which included an increase in the top tax rate and a bunch of other tax increases in there. This was done without a single Republican vote. It was done with 51 votes in the Senate, including Al Gore casting the deciding vote as vice president. So that's what brought us onto the road to fiscal sanity that became the Clinton Clinton achievement. The only achievement of the Clinton presidency really was balancing the books, and eventually through the Republican budget cutting of Newt Gingrich, building up a large surplus. But the first 2 years was a hugely successful period for Bill Clinton, except for the health care disaster, which occurred in his second year.
Well, then, just in closing, Lawrence O'Donnell, obviously, as a Democrat, you would hope that the Democratic Party will find its Gingrich revolution, and that what happened to the Democrats in 94 will happen to the Republicans in 06.
That's where we are in Social Security now. The Social Security bill that Bush wants to do has to go through the Senate Finance Committee, where I used to be the chief of staff. And I'm telling you, Ian, this is an identical situation to the Clinton health care bill trying to squeeze through that committee. It's not going to happen. It's dead already. Then the overreach involved is really quite wild. And if the Democrats play this thing as well as the Republicans played defense against Hillary's health care plan, the Democrats have a very, very strong chance of retaking the House or the Senate in the next election. This is an extremely politically dangerous thing that the president is doing. Republican House members know this. Republican senators know this. They see what's happening. They are trying to distance themselves from the president, but it's difficult to do. And so this is the spot where the Democrats might just get lucky if the Republicans and the president continue to wildly overplay this hand on Social Security.
Well, just in closing, who's the Democrats' Newt Gingrich?
They don't have one. Newt Gingrich, in my view, was the most influential political figure of the second half of the 20th century. Everything he wanted has happened. And I'm not sure that the Democrats need that. The Democrats' case should be, we are the self-interest party. The way you talk to anti-abortion people in Kentucky and try to get them to vote for the Democrat, as long as that's not their only issue. If that's their only issue, they're gone and you can't talk to them and forget about them. But the way you talk to them is self-interest. You say, here's what we will do for your Social Security in the future. Here's what we will do to preserve your wages in the job that you have. Here's what we will do to preserve jobs here. And so the Democrats should be approaching the American population as the self-interest party, because a minimum of 65% of the American public's self-interest is more attached to Democratic policies than to Republican policies.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Lawrence O'Donnell.
Thanks, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Lawrence O'Donnell, who's an Emmy Award-winning producer of NBC's The West Wing. He's also MSNBC's senior political analyst and a panelist on the McLaughlin Group. And I'm now speaking with Bozu Daragani, who is a Middle East-based correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. He's in Tehran, in Iran at the moment, having been in Iraq. He also wrote a piece in the San Francisco Chronicle describing the elections as the Sistani tsunami. Why is it that the White House appears to be practicing or engaging in premature elation when it looks as though the real winners in this election are the Dawa and the Supreme Council.
I'm not sure why they're doing that. I think they're spinning it to a certain extent. We noticed that in Baghdad with a lot of the U.S. embassy people sort of saying, hey, we don't care what they call it. They can call it the Islamic Republic of Iraq as long as they respect human rights and stuff like that. And then I saw, I don't know if anyone else heard this, with Donald Rumsfeld talking on TV on one of the Sunday morning shows saying, you know, hey, you know, when the U.S. Constitution was created, they didn't give women and blacks rights either. So sort of preparing for the worst-case scenario in which, you know, the clerically dominated political group takes control of the government and insists on an Islamically-based constitution.
Well, you're a reporter in Iraq. Did our press get spun by the military? This U.S. military ran this election, and there's some suspicion that it was almost like a run like a psyop, because the press have just absolutely parroted everything that they were handed, and a tremendous amount of elation and celebration on the part of the administration when the results indicate something quite different. So did you think that the press got played by the military authorities?
I think that's a little unfair to say that the press got played by the military authorities. I think there was one day in Iraq where hope and bravery overcame the ever-present fear. And it was a pretty magical day, and it was a pretty special event. People who'd been oppressed for so long, you had a situation where bombs were exploding nearby, and people would go out and they would go and vote, and, you know, they were just not afraid. And that was pretty remarkable, a testament to the human spirit. Perhaps unfortunately for the Bush administration, and maybe unfortunately to those who sort of hope for a liberal, progressive politics developing in the Middle East, they went and voted for a party that's not, you know, they went and voted for a group of people that's very Islamist. That might be the consequence of that. But I think there was a certain amount of euphoria on that one day. And then quickly thereafter, as we've seen, you know, the kidnappings and the killings have started up again at a feverish pitch.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't in any way suggest that what happened there wasn't heartening to see people voting, and particularly people who've been so oppressed for so long. But in terms of the PSYOP idea, is just the extent to which our preliminary information was about huge turnout, and even strong turnout amongst the Sunni, none of which really panned out, or at least the figures have been downsized somewhat.
Yeah, absolutely. I think definitely the extent of Sunni participation was exaggerated. But as far as the Western media is concerned, I think they are at least waking up to the sort of realities of the election, the day after kind of effect. Mm-hmm. Seen a few strong stories in the mainstream press about the Islamists in Najaf pushing for a Islamic constitution. You've seen the reports, obviously, of the sudden increase in kidnappings of foreigners as well.
Sure. Let me bring in Dr. Juan Cole, who is widely considered one of the leading scholars on the contemporary Iraq. Dr. Cole is a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. And he's the author of a recent article on Salon.com, The Shiite Earthquake. We have on with us Dr. Juan Cole, Bozo Daragani, who is in Tehran, having just been in Iraq. And given that we were just talking about Bozo Daragani's article in the San Francisco Chronicle, the Sistani Tsunami, and your article, The Shiite Earthquake, it sounds like you're both talking about the same thing.
Yes, well, Bozo and I have had correspondence, and I've benefited a great deal from his reporting. It's wonderful to be on with him. Obviously we're both seeing the same thing here in Iraqi politics, which is a huge shift in parliamentary politics. away from a tradition of Sunni Arab minority dominance. And then I would say that a very interesting development may well be that the United Iraqi Alliance, the main Shiite party, which looks very much like it may get over 50% of the seats in parliament, brings into power a very large number of people who are indigenous revolutionaries. So the old Dawa Party, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, people who had fought against Saddam for years and years and years. There are tribal sheikhs of the Middle Euphrates who are clients of Sistani. And so you could say that the Sunni Arab minority dominance was already gone with the American invasion and the interim government of Iyad Alawi. But Alawi and his group were ex-Baathists. A lot of them had been old CIA contacts from outside the country. And now indigenous forces in some ways are coming to the fore.
But isn't it also true that when Condoleezza Rice and Rumsfeld and others talk about the Iraqi army that the United States has trained and give it, you know, figures 150,000 thereabouts, almost all of those people are Shiite or the Peshmerga of Kurdish militias?
Yeah, the new Iraqi forces that are being formed are heavily Shiite and Kurdish, and moreover, when they have been committed to battle, it has been the Kurds, in particular, to a lesser degree, the Shiites, who have tended to stand firm and actually fight. The Sunni Arab component tends then to desert or not to show up, or even sometimes to defect to the other side. So it's been very difficult to get Arab Iraqis to fight other Arab Iraqis for what they see as on behalf of the United States.
And Boza Daraghi in Tehran, does it strike you as an irony that the army that the United States is training could be, I don't know for sure, but you could make the case that it might well be more sympathetic to Iran than to the United States?
Yeah, I mean, definitely the ties between not only the Shias, but also the Kurds in Iran are quite strong, even beyond the issue of the Islamic Republic. There's a long historical ties between Iraqi Shias in the south as well as the Kurds in the north to Iran. No one's quite sure how that's going to play out. You know, on the other hand, you know, Arabs and Persians have been competing with each other for a long time. But it does, you know, and I think that's one of the worries that Israel has, is that the United States is busily preparing an army that's going to, eventually align with Iran against them.
And, of course, recently Iran was singled out by Vice President Cheney as possibly being on the Israeli hit list, and Condoleezza Rice on her European trip, which she's still in the midst of, went to great lengths to say that the United States is not planning on attacking Iran, but it's out there in the ether. So, again, you're in Tehran. It's a little ironic, isn't it, that we're one part of the government is saying Iran's on the hit list, the other part, but the results on the ground, engineered largely by the U.S. military, seem to be benefiting Iran.
That's kind of one of the many confusing things about U.S. foreign policy and U.S. statements and so on. On the one hand, also they were saying that the Iranians were helping the insurgents, and then they were saying that the Iranians were helping the Skiri and Dawa and so on. And now the insurgents were killing and car bombing Skiri and Dawa. So which is it? Are they, helping the Shia politicians, or are they helping the Sunni insurgents that are killing the Shia politicians? You never can figure out the U.S. Statements on those kinds of things.
And Dr. Juan Cole, you were commenting for the NewsHour on PBS during the elections, and you said that most American analysts and journalists, by extension, seem to be over-obsessed with the idea that Iraq is poised for civil war and that the Sunni-Shia divide is in stone. Yet, given that the army that that we have is a Peshmerga Shiite army, and clearly the Shiites, the Sunni feel alienated, and they are the insurgency. So where do you get this feeling that we're overstating the sectarian divides, that there is some incipient nationalism there, when these elections appear to have actually done what Brent Scowcroft was worried about, sort of laid down the landscape of a divided nation?
Well, there isn't any doubt that Iraqis at the moment are divided and largely along ethnic lines. I don't think that has always been a salient dividing line in Iraqi modern Iraqi history. There's a very strong sense of Iraqi nationalism in among the Arab population, at the very least. And what my point was really about talk of partition, and to say that I know of no significant political party in Iraq that has ever advocated partition of any sort. The parties seem to be pretty dedicated to keeping the country together, and that what the Sunnis and Sunni Arabs and the Shiites each want is not, in fact, to be separate, but to have the whole enchilada, if you will, to be dominant in the politics of the entire country, and they want the whole country. So my point was really about the allegation that Iraq is on the verge of breakup, which I don't believe to be true. I think there's a huge tectonic shift going on away from Sunni Arab dominance. These were the Sunni Arabs were the WASPs of the country. They were the managerial class. If you went into a high government office, almost certainly there would be a Sunni Arab sitting there. They were the officer class at the upper reaches. And they benefited disproportionately from the oil revenue, a lot of millionaires amongst them, and so forth. So those people are now being swept aside and subordinated to other forces. And so this is a huge shift, and you know, there's going to be a period of adjustment, which isn't going to be pretty, and I expect continued violence from Sunni Arabs. But it should also be said that Sunni Arabs are not of all one kind. There are lots of secular middle-class people who are nervous about this insurrection. There are other hardcore elements that are still, you know, hoping for a third Ba'ath coup, and then there are Salafis and the Sunni fundamentalists. So there are lots of things going on inside the Sunni Arab community. It's not all one thing.
Boza Daragahi in Tehran, you're the Middle East-based correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle, and you covered the recent elections in Iraq. What's your reading on whether obviously there's tremendous anti-Americanism in the country, not just from the insurgency, but somebody like Muqtada al-Sadr, who didn't really want to participate in the election. Nevertheless, his surrogates did very well, and they're, of course, resolutely anti-American. So you're getting a mixed signal here. On the one hand, there seems to be a lot of opposition to the occupation. It's probably the one thing that most Iraqis agree on, that they like the Americans out. But then you also hear that there's also a pragmatic streak amongst Iraqis that know that as much as they don't like the current situation, they know if the Americans left, there'd be chaos. So navigate us through those, if that's indeed something that is accurate.
I would think that the Shias that are about to inherit power, and I've heard this said by them before, you know, they've been patient for many, 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 many years, and they'll continue to be patient for a few years to come in allowing for an orderly, peaceful training of their armed forces by the Americans, and then a, you know, orderly, peaceful exit by the U.S. forces from Iraq. And they're going to be on their best behavior. They're going to give Sunni Arabs prominent posts in the government. And they know that if they don't, that if they abuse the power they have now, they'll just prolong the occupation. And then when the U.S. forces leave, then they'll have a little bit more of a freer hand to you know, perhaps deal with the insurgency the way they want to deal with it. Institute the types of Islamic laws that they've tried to put in place in the past, even in the governing council, with regard to marriage laws and inheritance laws and so on, that they were not able to put on with the eyes of the West and the U.S. here. I think they're going to be very patient. And what you're going to see on the part of the dominant Shia groups is a kind of, you know, being on their best behavior for a while, and then they'll do what they really want to do when the U.S. forces are leaving or about to leave.
So is it likely then that we'll be hearing from, you know, perhaps Alawi or somebody on the Iraqi side calling for a scheduled withdrawal of the United States troops?
I don't think Alawi is going to call for that. I wouldn't say this necessarily, but a lot of Iraqis say that Alawi came in on a U.S. tank. Why would he want the U.S. tanks to leave?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you're going to hear Alawi saying that. Alawi might be cut out to the extent that he was invited to join the Sistani list, and he didn't. He decided to go on his own, and he spent millions and millions of dollars on a very slick ad campaign and still couldn't come up with many votes in this past election. And I think a lot of the Shias, or the triumphant Shias, they're like, maybe he deserves a post in the government. Yeah, sure, he should have a role, you know, deputy finance minister or something like that. But they're quite pleased to cut him out. But, you know, you're gonna see on the part of the more mature Shia leadership from the Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution of Iraq a kind of diplomatic attitude towards the U.S. occupation.
But just to pin it down, though, do you think that these elections will be the beginning of some kind of fig leaf or structure behind which the United States can pull out, if you accept the notion that this thing has been bungled and largely miscalculated, and that the White House, in spite of their public rhetoric, it's probably a millstone that they'd like to get out from under?
Well, I'm not sure of that. I'm not sure if the U.S. wants to get out. If they wanted to get out, I wouldn't see them. You know, I see a lot of new bases being built in Iraq. I see a lot of infrastructure and hardware being brought to the country by the U.S. And them really building up their military infrastructure in the country. You know, I think it depends. Will the U.S. leave? It depends to some extent on whether the U.S. wants to leave.
And Dr. Juan Cole, do you think that the U.S. is digging in, or that the insurgency is going to either continue or grow and wear us down?
Well, the plan of the Pentagon, which was announced by Mr. Wolfowitz in spring of 2003, was to get back down to about a division in Iraq by October of 2003. So that was what they had hoped for, was the U.S., I think the Department of Defense, Bush administration, wanted a permanent base or set of bases in Iraq, and they wanted to position in Iraq about 20,000 men, about a division. And so by analogy to what happened in Japan and South Korea after World War II and after the Korean War, that the U.S. would have a military position in the Persian Gulf region in Iraq, and it would be a friendly country that would grant the U.S. Leasing of bases. Of course, they had to keep many more divisions than one in Iraq up until the moment. But I think that they still do hope for a permanent military position in Iraq. It was one of the reasons, I believe, they went to war. Whether they will be able to get that is another question, because, of course, I think a sovereign country can ask the U.S. to leave, and it will have to leave. The Philippines did that recently. So the question is whether the U.S. Missteps in Iraq have so alienated the Iraqi people from the United States that popular opinion would just force the government ultimately to ask the Americans to withdraw altogether. I think that's still for the future. We don't know the answer to that question. My own suspicion is that there will not be long-term U.S. military presence in Iraq, that future governments will ask it to leave. I don't think that the Shiite new political class will ask the U.S. to leave immediately, because the Sunni Arab Baathists who are fighting this guerrilla war will kill them, and the U.S. is all that stands between them and simply being taken out and shot.
But they do have that army that we talked about, and so does the Peshmerga have an army.
Yes, but the I believe personally that the military capabilities of the remnants of the Ba'ath are such that they would make mincemeat out of the Shiites if they fought each other.
And Bozu Daragahi in Tehran, do you think that that this this situation can be stabilized, that George W. Bush will end up being vindicated, and that we'll have permanent bases there, or will we end up with Fort Apaches in a hostile land?
I think that the latter scenario is probably more likely. I think that I think it's going to be really. I think the U.S. is going to go out kicking and screaming in the end. What good was this war if the U.S. doesn't get some bases out of it? What was good was this whole operation? I don't think even if the. First of all, I think that the U.S. outmaneuver any future government of Iraq to make sure that they don't request that the bases are withdrawn. But I think it's not going to be so easy for the U.S. to leave after having committed so much blood and so much treasure to this whole adventure. You look at past wars throughout history, and maybe there's many instances where a country should have pulled out of an adventure, and it didn't because it had already given up so much towards that adventure. And I don't think the U.S. is going to leave anytime soon.
So, how will it work then? Is there a way for the footprint to be reduced and for autonomy to take over? And would that lower the anger threshold and allow for these kind of Fort Apaches to be like at Balad or somewhere like that?
I just don't know how it'll work. I think we all have to sort of sit back and watch, because this is pretty much uncharted terrain as far as the U.S. goes to be in a situation like this. This government that's coming to power, this Shia government is by definition it was anti-American. You go to a scary mosques and they say death to America, death to Israel at Friday prayers, and I just don't know how they're going to. It's going to be uncomfortable bedfellows for a while.
Well, just let me, I thank you for joining us. Let me just, from Tehran, Bozu Daragahi, let me just finish up with one call. Dr. Cole, it seemed to be for the longest time that the insurgents have had the initiative here. Do you think that these elections and their results have allowed the United States to recapture the initiative, or have they actually thrown a complete spanner in the works and allowed other players to capture the initiative in the form of the Shia and the Kurds?
I believe that in the short to medium term, the elections were irrelevant to the insurgency. That's being fought by people who reject the new situation altogether, and they will go on blowing things up for some years to come, in my view. So the elections are just irrelevant to that. I think the real question is the relationship of the United States to the emergent Shiite political class. And I think that the two sides for the moment are cynically using one another. The Shiites need the Americans to finish off the Sunni insurgency. The Americans need the Shiites because they're now the majority of the country and have come to power in parliament. But I can imagine a situation, say, a couple, three, four, 5 years down the road where the Sunni Arab insurgency has been reduced to a level of marginality, that the Shiites are self-confident that they can now handle the situation, even though it hasn't completely gone away, and where Grand Ayatollah Sistani decides the time is ripe for the Americans to leave, and if they don't, he calls hundreds of thousands of people into the streets every day until they do. And I think that's a trump card. I think the U.S. just has to go then.
I thank you both for joining us, Dr. Juan Cole and Bozu Daragahi from Tehran. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and I was just speaking then with Dr. Juan Cole, who's a professor of contemporary Iraq, Middle Eastern Studies, and South Asian History at the University of Michigan, and Bozu Daragahi, who's a Middle East correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle, who's covered the elections in Iraq and is now in Tehran, in Iran. I'm now speaking with Dr. John Guymon, who is the president of Physicians for a National Health Program and the author of a just-released book, Falling Through the Safety Net, Americans Without Health Insurance. President Bush in his State of the Union, obviously he talked a lot about Social Security, in quotes, reform. We'll be talking about that in the second hour with an economist who was the first to suggest that the Social Security crisis was a phony crisis. But let's just focus in on what the president said in the State of the Union about his intentions to reform, again in quotes, the health care situation in this country. He's talking about a consumer-driven health care. What does he mean by a consumer-driven health care?
Well, Ian, the whole trend right now is the biggest problem is the affordability or unaffordability of health care and the unrestrained increases of cost of health care, which go up way above the cost of living. So that's the main problem. There have been many incremental efforts to revise and to deal with this problem, including managed care in the 1980s and 90s, which failed to control prices and costs and other approaches. But the employer-based health insurance system, which we've had for 60 years or so, is pretty much frayed now. Employers are squeezed and having a hard time covering their employees as they had in the past. So now the whole trend is to shift more costs of health care to patients and their families. And consumer-driven health care rests on the premise that if people would just be more prudent in their choices about health care, that they would contain costs. That puts all the blame on the increasing cost of health care on patients and their families, and that's really not where it should be.
Well, the president seems to think that these absolutely out of control burgeoning health care costs, already past 4% of GDP, are to do with irresponsible lawsuits. I mean, frivolous lawsuits, I think is the phrase he uses, as though that's the cause. I mean, I thought that the inherent problem here was that the worst people in the world are in healthcare in this country, and that is the insurance companies. That you could, yeah. It's literally like having Dracula in charge of the blood bank. You have the insurance companies are only interested in healthy people because they represent profit. Sick people represent a loss.
Exactly.
They are an unnecessary layer between the patient and the caregiver, and they extract their pound of flesh by simply charging whatever the overhead is. That's their profit margin. I mean, there was a study done recently on kidney dialysis where they had the private group of the private insurance or privately run kidney dialysis and the publicly run one, and the study indicated that the privately run one had much, much lower standard of care, and the lower standard of care was in direct proportion to their profit margin.
Precisely.
So you can see what the dynamic out there is, and to me, this is nobody in the healthcare debate ever talks about why the situation's out of control. It's because the wrong people are running it.
Well, that's exactly true. Now, this is fully predictable, too. Dr. Arnold Relman is an internist and professor of medicine in the East at Harvard, and warned us in the 70s about a medical industrial complex, and that is exactly what's happened. We have healthcare considered a commodity for sale on the open market. It's not a social need. It's on the open market, and we have a very much investor and for-profit driven system. Dialysis units are 85% for profit in this country, investor-owned. Nursing homes are 70%. HMOs are 65% for-profit, investor-owned. And the insurance industry is largely investor-owned as well. Even Blue Cross, which has a great tradition in this country dating back to 1930 or so, and community rating and social needs responsive and not-for-profit, even Blue Cross around the country now, about a third of their coverage or plans are for-profit and investor-owned. So, yes, the insurers are very much in charge, and the system has become unresponsive to the needs of more and more of the population. And even the middle class now, more and more, has trouble affording health care.
So why is there this disconnect with reality and the absence of anybody talking about this 900-pound gorilla, that the problem is that the wrong people are in charge, and the people that used to be in charge, and when it used to be a non-profit and a social right rather than an economic privilege.
The problem is political and education, public education. I say political because both major parties are pretty much bought off by the lobby groups of the stakeholders. And the stakeholders include the insurance industry, the drug industry, medical supplies industry, medical device industries, and all the stakeholders in keeping it the way it is.
Well, but how can they support the obvious unreality of the situation, where the press go along with the vilification of the Canadian health system? And here we are next door to a country that routinely is considered by the United Nations the country with the highest standard of living in the world, and the U.S. is way down on the list by comparison in terms of the quality of life. Yet our press and politicians propagandize us to believe that the Canadians are on the brink of a medical meltdown, and they're getting substandard care in spite of the United Nations studies always giving them the highest standard of living in the world. And yet at the same time, we're having to import cheap drugs from Canada. So this is where I just don't understand why there's not a counter argument out there, because the single payer model is the simplest. It gets rid of this parasitic layer of the insurance company, who, whatever their overhead, they're going to take it out of your care and of course take you to the cleaner, because we just learned from this new Harvard study that medical costs are responsible now for most of the personal bankruptcy in this country, and they're also the leading cause of bankruptcy in small businesses.
Yep. Well, this is exactly true. There's it comes down again to a political problem, and the media is complicit often in putting out more disinformation and not being critical enough of what they're being told by lobbyists and politicians. There's all kinds of disinformation about the Canadian system. It does perform better than ours. And if they were funded as we are, they would have the best system in the world by far.
We spend more than anybody per capita, but we cover the least amount of people.
That's exactly right. It's a complex subject, but one main thing you can say is where we're headed is not sustainable. And increasingly, people are either uninsured, that's 45 million today, it's going up quickly, or tremendously underinsured, and this consumer-driven healthcare trend may, quote, insure some more people, but the insurance often is so phony and lacking in coverage that you can't really call it insurance. So right now we have a system out of control. It's meeting the needs of the stakeholders. It's increasingly not meeting the needs of people, and we're going to hit a brick wall.
Well, but though, how do you generate a counter strategy here? Because I guarantee you that everybody that I know is angry about their rising health care and their plans going up and the coverage going down. It's palpable throughout the entire society. So everybody is angry. Nobody likes the current system.
Right.
But nobody is giving them the good news is that there is a simpler, easier, fairer, and cheaper way to do this. It just happens to be one that doesn't have any political support or support in the press.
Well, there's more political support than we might guess. There are public polls over 40 years or so that show the public in general is supportive of a of government-financed health care. Now, this is usually framed in many of these polls in a way that, well, it's often asked, would you support a government healthcare system, you know, which sounds like it's totally government-run, but instead the question should be asked, would you support a system of nationally financed health care, which is affordable for everyone and available to everyone, but delivered through a private system of private doctors and private providers and private hospitals. It's never asked that way.
Right, because it's a real simple thing. It's just about pooling the money, right?
Sure, it's exactly. If you have a broad insurance pool, then you can do the best for everyone. The way we are now, the private insurers cherry-pick the healthy from the sick and leave the sick to the government safety net programs, and we're in big deficits, so they get less and less care. But the bottom line is something like 10% of the population uses 72% of the cost of health care. Those are the chronically ill and the sick. And so the only way to deal with that is to spread the risk through a large number of people and not just have them segregated off to the safety net system.
Well, Dr. John Geiman, I thank you very much for joining us. Again, you're the president of the Physicians for National Health Program, and we're talking about the healthcare crisis in this country that's not being addressed at all in any rational way, and we just keep spending more and more money on this less and less, more and more dysfunctional and expensive juggernaut. I thank you for joining us.
And I thank you for covering this subject. It is a crisis subject.
And I thank the engineer, Mark Maxwell, the producer, Lewis Vandenberg, and the assistant producer, Carol Coote. And this program and all previous ones are available at ianmasters.org.